dangerously from Axis control. They sought to meet this challenge with a baleful mix of divide-and-rule measures and sometimes savage terror. This did nothing to arrest the decline of German control in the Balkans. It did, however, fuel the havoc that was engulfing the region and its civilian population. In the event of all Italy trying to change sides, the Germans had devised Operation Axis. This was to be a full-scale military takeover of Italy and its southern European territories, intended to secure communication lines, disarm Italian forces, and organize the region's defense against Allied attack. The Badoglio government's shambolic failure to conceal its negotiations with the Allies prompted the Germans to initiate the operation immediately. The majority of Italian formations at most command levels allowed themselves to be disarmed, and their personnel interned. General Balck, in Italy as acting commander of 14 Panzer Corps, claimed in his memoirs that during the disarmament operation, one Italian officer told us that he could only hand over his battery once he had fired it. "Why don't you aim 50 meters to the right and fire into the air?" He did that, and then surrendered his battery. Another battery commander shot himself. His people cried and wailed for him and started a huge lament. Then they happily dispersed. Farcical as this account may seem, such was Balck's generally balanced post-war judgment of Italian troops' fighting power that it is unlikely he was concocting such stories. In any case, the majority of Italian formations went quietly. This was despite the fact that most of the Italian army's rank-and-file troops, less so its officers, were now thoroughly ill-disposed towards fascism and the Axis. But on the several occasions when Italian units did refuse to comply with orders to lay down their arms, they were overpowered violently and often without mercy. Some of the most ruthless treatment the Germans dealt out to the Italians was the work of elite troops that did not belong to the army, Waffen-SS, paratroopers, and Brandenburger special forces. Many army-led commands acted swiftly and ruthlessly against the Italians, but not murderously. On Corsica, in the previously Italian-occupied zone of southern France, for instance, Field Marshal von Rundstedt informed Italian troops that they would be treated as irregulars and shot if after 12 hours they did not give themselves up. He concentrated their minds further by bringing forward the deadline by 2 hours and reminding them that from Turin, the Leibstandarte Adolf Hitler is marching on your rear. At least Rundstedt was giving the Italians an opportunity to surrender. In southeast Europe, and particularly in parts of Greece, the Germans sometimes failed to observe any such niceties. Responsibility for disarming Italian forces fell to the new commander-in-chief southeast, Field Marshal von Weichs. This new post, which had originally been created in December 1942, invested Weichs with greater powers than standard territorial Wehrmacht commanders. The importance attached to Weichs's post reflected the particular size of the partisan threat in southeast Europe. In view of this and of the region's potential exposure to Allied invasion, the prospect of hundreds of thousands of armed anti-Axis Italian troops at liberty was not one that Weichs wished to entertain. When Operation Axis commenced, he ordered that because Italian forces in southeast Europe had formally agreed to surrender their weapons, any of their troops failing to do so must be punished with all severity. It was in the Greek islands, also within Weichs's remit, that the Germans sought to make the most terrifying example of any Italian units that resisted. Such was the strategic position of these islands that the Germans feared the Allies would take them over amid the confusion of an Italian surrender and threaten the entire German position in the eastern Mediterranean. They thus subjected any resisting Italian soldiers there to particular ferocity in order to deter their comrades from similar actions. In the Dodecanese, the Germans gave the Italians the option of surrendering beforehand. They overcame fierce Italian resistance on roads, but Lieutenant General Ulrich Kleemann, the garrison commander, initially refused to execute captured Italian military personnel. However, his superiors then compelled him to do so. In the Ionian Islands, 22 Mountain Corps likewise gave the Italian troops on Corfu the option of surrendering, but the 1st Mountain Division still seems to have shot many Italian soldiers who tried to surrender after the fighting. Nowhere was German conduct worse than on the Ionian island of Cephalonia. The army units that attacked the Italians there were the 104th Light Division, Fortress Grenadier Battalion 910, and again the 1st Mountain Division. On 18 September, the OKW informed Field Marshal von Weichs that, due to the cruel and treacherous conduct on Cephalonia, no prisoners are to be taken. 2 days later, General Löhr got in on the act, re-emphasizing the exceptional nature of the situation and the need for a total lack of consideration. There is no evidence that the German formations attacking the Italians on Cephalonia even made them aware of what awaited them if they did not surrender. The most exhaustive study of the massacres on Cephalonia has concluded that about 2,500 Italian soldiers perished. Some were killed in the initial bombardment and fighting, but the great majority were murdered after being taken prisoner. In some cases, the Germans did not even bury the bodies, but weighted them with stones and threw them out to sea. The 1st Mountain Division and the 104th Light Division had both fought at length in the Yugoslav anti-partisan campaign. Indeed, the 1st Mountain Division had also fought extensively in the east. The ferocity with which the war was waged in both theatres made the soldiers of such divisions more likely to be in full agreement with the ferocity expected of them in Operation Axis. However, some Italian soldiers from the groups that were massacred were able to drag themselves away, wounded, and find the help of the Greek resistance. Moreover, the Germans eventually spared a number of Italian soldiers on Cephalonia, together with medical officers and military priests. None of this, however, detracts from the fact that approaching 2,500 Italian soldiers were massacred after they had surrendered. This death toll comprised by far the biggest portion of the approximately 6,500 Italian soldiers who met this fate, the majority of them in the former Italian occupation zones of Greece and Yugoslavia. Around the same number were killed in the fighting during Operation Axis. Another 13,000 drowned when the transport ships they were on either capsized through overloading or were bombed by the Allies. Although the ruthlessly swift character of Operation Axis was in large part driven by strategic necessity, further influences gave the Germans' conduct an even sharper edge. There was widespread anger among the military leadership that Germany had been knifed in the back by an erstwhile ally. Italy's attempt to change sides in 1943 awoke memories of 1914, when Italy had shirked its commitment to the Triple Alliance with Germany and Austria-Hungary before later joining the side of the Allies. General Balck, for instance, bitterly raked over the embers in his memoirs, remarking that for the second time in just a few decades, Italy had broken treaty with its allies and even appearing to question its future commitment to NATO. It also reinforced the contempt many German officers and soldiers had felt with regard to the Italians since their entry into the current war. For one thing, although the Italians had frequently inflicted cruel treatment upon the subjects of their Balkan Empire, still more so upon those of their African colonies, German officials had long regarded Italian imperial aspirations as a bad joke. Major General Edmund Gläser von Horstenau was the Wehrmacht's official representative to the NDH government. In June 1941, he told Field Marshal Keitel, "If this laughable, inflated Italian imperialism is not liquidated during this war or on its conclusion, the war will have had no meaning." German soldiers themselves often regarded their Italian comrades in arms, however unfairly, as lackadaisical, slovenly, and unsoldierly. Typical was the view of Unteroffizier Karl A. of the 5th Panzer Division when he described a brush with Italian soldiers in Greece in May 1941. "Yesterday we were in Patras. There we saw our first Italian soldiers. Correction, we've seen quite a few who had previously been captured. And these Italian types please us even less. A street patrol, for instance, of about 8 men with machine guns and so on, was just walking through the streets, larking about, singing arm in arm, a civilian among them. That would be forbidden with us." Of course, perceptions such as this helped feed the equally widespread, equally unjustified view that Italian troops were useless in the field. And during Operation Axis, the two German army group commanders in Italy itself, Rommel in the north and Kesselring in the south, issued a joint declaration along similar lines. It maligned the Italian soldiers and officers who opposed German orders to surrender as riffraff. Operation Axis was not about unbridled slaughter, however. For one thing, Rommel and Kesselring were at least giving the Italian troops the opportunity to surrender. In the northern Italian jurisdiction of Rommel's Army Group B, Italian troops were disarmed more swiftly than they were elsewhere. In 10 days, the Army Group disarmed 82 generals, 13,000 officers, and over 400,000 NCOs and rank-and-file soldiers. It almost certainly committed criminal executions as well, but on a smaller scale than elsewhere. And knowing Rommel's aversion to brutal anti-partisan measures, it is perhaps not that surprising that even Waffen-SS units of his army group treated captured partisans as POWs during the weeks following Operation Axis. On the other hand, the welter of merciless commands directed against Italian soldiers during Operation Axis, including Rommel and Kesselring's opprobrious talk of riffraff, was bound to tap into the wellspring of anti-Italian contempt among many German soldiers. Over the weeks that followed, soldiers' inhibitions weakened to a point where army divisions feared for their discipline. Thus, on 21 October 1943, for instance, the 16th Panzer Division reported, "Since the outbreak of hostilities on the Italian peninsula, there are ever more frequent cases of individual soldiers or members of small commands roaming through the land like marauders from the 30 Years' War. Both Rommel and Kesselring felt compelled to intervene against the wilder excesses." Allied forces, under the collective command of General Alexander's 15th Army Group, landed in southern Italy in early September 1943. Against Montgomery's 8th Army's landing at Calabria on 3 September, the Germans steadily withdrew while laying to waste the areas they abandoned. Montgomery advanced using overwhelming firepower, but also showing his usual caution, so he did not hurry the Germans on their way. The Germans provided a much louder reception for U.S. General Mark Clark's 5th Army when it landed at Salerno on 9 September. Initially, Salerno seemed a great opportunity for the Germans to push an Allied landing back into the sea. It was too far from Calabria for the Americans to link up easily with the British, but it was the only place where the Americans could land. They needed to hit the coast near a major port that would enable them to bring over support from Sicily. They also needed to land at a beach on which two corps would have room both to move and to stockpile supplies. Salerno was the only potential landing place that ticked both boxes. However, the landing area was an easily observable bowl, an easy target for the German guns, and a narrow front upon which the Germans could concentrate their forces for counterattack. The Battle of Salerno again enabled the German army to demonstrate that it could defend pugnaciously and execute a mobile counterattack skillfully. But it also further demonstrated the German army's frailty in the face of overwhelming Allied firepower. During the U.S. landing, the 16th Panzer Division launched a counterattack on the beach itself. The division's order to its troops invoked the fighting spirit of the winter battles on the Eastern Front as proof that, whilst the British and American forces might be superior to the Wehrmacht in material and aircraft, they are not superior in morale. True as this might be, the battle showed that it did not matter. Largely bereft of air support and facing colossal Allied naval and aerial firepower, the 16th Panzer Division's armor suffered grievously. For 2 days, the Germans licked their wounds while the Americans consolidated their forces on the beach. On 13 September, a strengthened panzer force broke through the U.S. lines and made for the sea. But it then had to slow while it crossed the burned bridge over the River Calore, and the delay enabled U.S. artillery to hit back. A U.S. paratroop drop against the Germans was crassly executed, but it bought the Americans time to build their manpower and firepower to levels that the Germans could not withstand. Meanwhile, the Germans were hammered, as on Sicily, from the air and sea. They withdrew, forced to accept that, though they were safe in the mountains around Salerno, they were fatally exposed in the open. But though the Allies were now established on the shores of southern Italy, they faced a grueling advance up the rest of the German-held peninsula. The Germans were determined to hold their Italian territory as long and as obstinately as possible. Hitler revealed the new administrative arrangements for Italy on 10 September. Northern Italy was divided into two operational zones under direct German administration, the Adriatic littoral and the Alpine foothills, each of which had a high commissioner and a Wehrmacht commander. Mussolini, following his dramatic rescue from Italian imprisonment by German commandos, was placed in charge of a supposedly allied government, the Italian Social Republic, RSI, which covered the rest of Axis-controlled Italy. Kesselring, commander-in-chief southwest from November 1943, held not only full operational command within the RSI's territory, but also full administrative rights as occupier, putting him in direct charge of SS-Obergruppenführer Karl Wolff, senior SS and police leader in Italy. Among the forces at Wolff's disposal were 3,000 men of the security police and SD. Despite Italian fascism's drastically diminished state, the RSI was not simply a German puppet. The Nazi foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, believed his ministry would gain more influence over Italian affairs if the country was officially independent rather than officially occupied, and to some extent the Germans had to make the reality fit the appearance. Ribbentrop's ambassador, Rudolf Rahn, acted as plenipotentiary of the Greater German Reich in Italy, with key influence over Italian affairs, including, crucially, direct access to Mussolini. Beneath him, in Italy as elsewhere, the vaguely delineated lines of responsibility created potential for rivalry between the Wehrmacht, the SS, and police, and Nazi economic agencies. Italy's nominally independent status was still more fiction than fact, but it did limit what the Germans could get away with. Indeed, Rahn used Italian independence to limit encroachments by other Reich agencies into Italian affairs. Rahn also strongly believed in collaboration and sought to limit the scale of the terror and exploitation to which Reich agencies might otherwise have subjected the country. Thus, though the Germans would spend the 20 months or so of their occupation scouring Italy for workers, they had to cooperate with the RSI authorities in doing so. The Wehrmacht had more success in the south in the chaotic circumstances directly following the Allied invasion. In Naples, which saw a rash and unsuccessful uprising against the Germans when the Allies landed, the Wehrmacht managed to sweep up 18,000 workers and send them north as slave labor. A much larger group that met a miserable fate was that great majority of Italian soldiers whom Operation Axis had disarmed without killing. The Germans classified them as military internees, a vague term that released the Germans from international obligations to treat them correctly as POWs. About 650,000 Italian military internees were sent north, minus food and water and in sealed rail wagons, to camps in Germany, occupied Europe, or the Army's operational area on the Eastern Front. Though some were treated better than others, they regularly suffered cold, hunger, paltry rations, and harsh treatment from Wehrmacht and SS guards. Generally, officers received rather better treatment than NCOs and rank-and-file soldiers, but they often had to endure rough treatment and poor medical supplies. The rank-and-file had to endure all this and more. They became whipping boys for the Italian betrayal and a huge source of labor. Indeed, Goebbels described the Italian supposed betrayal as good business. Because the Germans had evaded all obligation to treat the military internees correctly, they were able to pack them off as slave workers into heavy industry and the armaments industry. The military internees comprised the largest group of foreigners whom the Germans exploited as forced labor during the war's last 2 years. The OKW, which was officially charged with responsibility for the internees, was especially keen to get them into the factories and German factory workers into uniform and onto the front lines as quickly as possible. Speer similarly wanted the internees fast-tracked into industry. Such haste meant that the internees were even more likely to suffer often dire standards of provisioning and accommodation. Over the next 20 months, they would suffer conditions comparable to those experienced by Soviet POWs at this stage in the war, with all the attendant misery and death rates. However, because the Italian civilian population itself did not directly suffer the same depths of rapacity that were now befalling populations as far apart as France, Greece, and the Soviet Union, partisan groups would be slow to develop on the peninsula. By mid-1944, a partisan movement was indeed making its presence felt, but the initial months of German occupation passed relatively quietly. Matters were very different in those areas that the Italians had hitherto occupied, above all in southeast Europe. The Reich leadership placed Montenegro under Wehrmacht command southeast. It treated Albania relatively leniently, seeing an opportunity to woo neutral Turkey with another display of enlightened treatment of Muslims. To this end, the Germans set up a national committee in Tirana. As elsewhere in the occupied southeast, however, they exploited the country for food and raw materials. But the most dramatic impact of Italy's exit from the Axis, the consequences of which involved the German army directly, was in the NDH in the former Yugoslavia. The Germans nominally took over the formerly Italian-occupied portion of the NDH, but still relied extensively upon indigenous pro-Axis forces to keep order. By now, however, this aspiration was no longer even barely credible, for Italy's exit from the Axis emphatically tipped the balance in the partisans' favor. Tito's partisans took advantage of Italy's exit from the Axis by expanding their territory in the NDH, seizing copious amounts of Italian equipment and weaponry, and welcoming a considerable number of former Italian soldiers into their ranks. The Germans were now desperate not to annihilate the partisans, something that was clearly beyond their means, but simply to contain them. By now, however, no measure the Germans took could achieve even this for very long. Himmler's recruitment of Bosnian Muslims into the Waffen-SS worsened the inter-ethnic mayhem while doing nothing decisive to check the partisans. The Germans' only other answer, as before, was the sledgehammer tactic of the Großunternehmen, irrespective of all the alienating chaos and misery these operations spawned. Indeed, by now the German occupiers were so desperate and their economic demands so voracious that their pronouncements became even more vicious than before. From August 1943, the month before Italy's collapse, General Löhr was already directing his men either to hang pro-partisan populations or to deport them for labor in the Reich. Löhr's fellow Austrian, General Rendulich, commanded the 2nd Panzer Army in the Balkans from September 1943 onwards. He lamented that the Germans in Yugoslavia did not have 20 divisions at their disposal, for then they could have brought peace to the country simply by killing everyone in it. By late 1943, their ongoing efforts to destroy the partisans having failed, the Germans' brutality was driving the population ever more firmly into the partisan camp. One soldier, Fritz K. of the 114th Light Division, believed a more informed occupation policy from the start might have avoided this outcome. "The land has not been pacified for some time, above all because our diplomacy made serious mistakes. Troops sent to this area had to look at the map to see where this country actually is. One can't hold on to 1% of the country and then fight the rest. That can't work. With a complete lack of instinct, we've overlooked the real dangers, and the result is that today everyone, and I mean everyone, is against us." Then in November, Britain, the main Allied power preoccupied with Balkan matters, shifted materiel support from Mihailovich's ineffective Chetniks to Tito's partisans. The Allies' presence in Italy also enabled them to supply and support the partisans by air and sea with growing ease. Yet even though the edifice of Axis occupation in Yugoslavia was disintegrating, the partisans' achievement needs putting in perspective. Though they tied down powerful German formations during 1943 and 1944, such troops were stationed there primarily for fear that the Allies might take advantage of the chaos and stage an invasion. Relatively few German formations were stationed in Yugoslavia for long, and those deployed for longer were substandard occupation divisions. Here, as elsewhere, partisans were unable to defeat German troops decisively in conventional combat. Of course, anyone offering this measured perspective to the increasingly desperate, brutalized German troops fighting the partisans would have met a brusque response indeed. In Greece, it was a similar story. By the time the Germans assumed control of the formerly Italian-occupied parts of Greece, Edes and Elas partisan groups proliferated in virtually all the mountainous areas of the mainland. Deeply negative stereotypes about the Greeks now proliferated among German troops. Arriving in Greece from Yugoslavia in April 1943, the 117th Light Division instructed its men that contact with the Greeks is forbidden. Any Greek, even when he gets on with the German, wants something from him. Commanders also increasingly expressed racist views about the Greeks. Such views were founded on the notion that the Greek people carried a certain amount of Semitic blood. The commander of the 164th Infantry Division, for instance, proclaimed that the troops should preserve their racial purity by avoiding sexual contact with Greek women. One of the most pervasive stereotypes was that Greeks, like Serbs, were bandits, criminally inclined, and capable of immense bloodlust and cruelty on account of their Balkan heritage. The 117th Light Division reported in December 1943, "The bandits are recruiting, chiefly from gangsters from the large cities." There was nothing accidental about such imagery. It corresponded exactly with the views that the highest-level orders of the SS and Wehrmacht increasingly propagated during 1942 and 1943. This was despite the fact that numerous German soldiers, whom Greek partisans captured, attested after the war to the favorable treatment they had received. The venom with which the Germans regarded Greek partisans and their civilian supporters reflected their immense frustration, for no method they employed was able to defeat the partisans. The Germans were too few in number to employ Jagdkommandos effectively. As in Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union, Großunternehmen could not prevent the enemy from returning to an area after the Germans had withdrawn. Defensive measures, such as strong points built along key roads, brought respite, but they also made the troops feel dangerously isolated. Indeed, the partisans played on this fear. Among other things, they dropped leaflets in German positions illustrating two German soldiers coming down a dark lane, one glancing nervously over his shoulder. The caption read, "German soldier, always look out, you're all alone." By 1944, the senior SS and police leader in Greece, Walter Shimana, was recruiting right-wing Greek auxiliaries to try and crush the partisans. Not only did this measure fail, it also plunged the country even further into civil war conditions. A short-lived attempt to co-opt EDS forces and use them against Elas partisans also failed, and by July 1944, EDS was attacking the Germans again. While some German commanders, such as Lieutenant General Hubert Lanz of 22 Mountain Corps, were justifiably skeptical about mass hostage-taking and reprisals, others were not. For instance, in April 1944, the 117th Light Division reacted to reports that partisans had shot 78 prisoners from its 749th Light Regiment near Kalavryta in the Peloponnese. In the reprisal campaign it went on to wage, it destroyed several villages and two monasteries and executed nearly 700 men. Such mass killings caused concern in some army command circles. General Lehr's chief of staff commented that it is unfortunately not possible to cut the head off everybody. When people proceed with an atonement action, they should go for the truly guilty and for the hostages, rather than razing places that have nothing to do with it to the ground. That only increases the bans. But higher-level Wehrmacht commands took no real action to curb or prevent such killings. Indeed, perhaps precisely because the Germans sensed they had no viable options for defeating the partisans, the higher command's views of the efficacy of reprisals was as confused in Greece as it was elsewhere. Luftwaffe General Wilhelm Speidel, brother of Hans, was the Wehrmacht commander in Greece from September 1943. He described mass reprisals as counterproductive, but also declared, "War is hard, and I should perhaps point out in regard to this that the German population is suffering incomparably heavier losses from English and American terror flights on German towns." Between March 1943 and October 1944, the Axis forces killed more than 21,000 Greeks. One mass killing deserving particular attention claimed the lives of more than 300 Greek villagers in Komenno, Epirus, in August 1943. Epirus was still nominally under Italian administration in August 1943, but for all practical purposes the Italians' anti-partisan effort in the region had already faded, and a 20,000-strong German force had now arrived to seize the reins of the campaign. Although it took place just before Italy's capitulation and the German takeover of formerly Italian-occupied Greece, the mass killing in Komenno foreshadowed the mounting savagery of the Germans' anti-partisan measures in Greece over the months that followed. The killings were not a reprisal. No German troops had been attacked in or around Komenno. The German commander whose regiment committed the killing, Colonel Josef Salminger, had spotted a few partisans in the village a few days previously. It was true that Edess and Elas both had lookout posts in the village, and Salminger also claimed his car was fired upon as it drove through, but this killing was intended to deter rather than to punish, and it was not a systematic execution but a massacre. The Germans arrived at dawn, broke into the villagers' homes, and killed them, irrespective of age or gender, using guns and hand grenades. The massacre was the work of the 98th Mountain Infantry Regiment, which was under one of General Lanz's subordinate divisions, the 1st Mountain Division. Major General Walter von Stettner, the divisional commander, and Colonel Salminger, the regimental commander, came from different backgrounds. Stettner was an aristocratic officer, while Salminger conformed to Hitler's ideal of the ruthless warrior who had advanced on merit. He was a working-class man who had risen through the ranks of the Reichswehr before receiving his commission in 1936. His words to his men on their arrival in Greece were, "This regiment is not just a German regiment, it is a Hitlerian regiment." Yet both officers were convinced practitioners of anti-partisan terror. They were protégés of Ferdinand Schörner, who commanded the 98th until 1940, and who in 1944 and 1945 would earn a singularly fanatical, ferocious reputation as an army group commander on the Eastern Front. The commander of the company who was selected to carry out the massacre, Lieutenant Röse, was a Nazi fanatic who had come up through the Hitler Youth. Nevertheless, he could not find enough volunteers among his 12th company, and so had to order two of the company's platoons to take part as well. Consequently, some of the soldiers who took part in the massacre spoke after the war of their horror at what had transpired. One eyewitness, who, by his own account, managed to hang back at the edge of the village as the slaughter unfolded, claimed to have heard soldiers shouting amid the shooting, "You do the firing! I can't! You've got a machine gun, so that's simple! I have to aim." Another commented, "I had not known until this point that there were sadists in the 12th Company," as he recalled comrades standing over the bodies of dead Greeks and cracking jokes at the corpse's expense. Nor was this post hoc justification. The troops got copiously drunk after the massacre, but there was no universal appetite for celebration. And in October 1943, the divisional chaplain reported, "The command to kill women and children in anti-bandit operations has imposed a great strain upon many men's consciences, including officers." On the other hand, not one man of the company mutinied or deserted, as on one occasion did men from an army penal battalion of political prisoners and criminals that had been assigned to anti-partisan operations in Greece. The fact that several members of Röse's company volunteered for the operation says much about the mindset within it. And judging from post-war interviews with men who had served in the company, many who were aghast at the massacre would have had no qualms about taking part in a disciplined reprisal against the village's adult males. In other words, the company comprised men who at worst relished participating in the massacre, or who at best, if that is the right expression, participated reluctantly, but would have participated willingly in an ordered mass killing. Indeed, the after-action report on Comenno tried to preserve the facade of military necessity, claiming that lots of ammunition went up in the air when Comenno's houses were burned down. Although the 12th Company had murdered 317 civilians, the report put the number at 150 and passed them off as enemy losses. And Comenno was only the biggest and most infamous massacre during a campaign in which, over the course of July and August 1943, the 1st Mountain Division destroyed 184 villages and killed nearly 1,300 Greek victims and nearly 500 Albanians. The division itself lost 22 men, along with 18 soldiers from Italian units accompanying it. That the 12th Company was such a willing instrument of terror, even if many of its men were repelled by the savage form it took in Comenno, was partly due to the influence of the command chain from division down to company, and partly due to other forces. Most of its men were barely into their 20s, had been socialized in the Hitler Youth and the RAD before joining the army, and had then served a year, perhaps two, in the brutalizing environments of the Eastern Front and the Yugoslav anti-partisan campaign. The conditions of the Greek anti-partisan campaign probably hardened them further. Such was the likely effect, for instance, of regularly seeing civilians' bodies hung from trees lining country roads or strung up on makeshift gallows in the town square, in the words of Mark Mazoa. That the war as a whole was now going against Germany, directly imperiling the homeland with it, probably hardened the men further. Among other things, Lieutenant Röser amplified the Wehrmacht commander's sentiments before his men went into Kamenno when he informed them that they must also kill everyone in the village because the English have bombed Cologne. Many innocent women and children have lost their lives in that bombardment. The men of the 12th Company also belonged to an elite formation with a particular sense of professional pride, something they would have contrasted with what they saw as the devious underhand tactics of the partisans. In short, while the 12th Company did not necessarily comprise brutalized ideological warriors to a man, its men had undergone experiences and imbibed influences that conformed to the ethos of the true National Socialist People's Army that Hitler was seeking to create. Prior to September 1943, much to the Nazi leadership's chagrin, Italian military and civilian officials had not generally been forthcoming in proffering their Jewish populations for the extermination camps. And on the mundane day-to-day level, numerous Italian officers had riled the Germans by visibly keeping the company of Jewish women. The German occupation of Italy and of Italy's erstwhile Greek and Yugoslav territories now pulled thousands more Jews into the Nazi crosshairs. In the hitherto Italian-occupied parts of the NDH, the Germans relied upon their Ustasha allies to gather up and deport the Jews to the death camps. In Italy, Field Marshal Kesselring initially wanted the country's 50,000-strong Jewish population kept alive, so he could use it to build fortifications to help stem the Allied advance. Hitler, however, ordered that the Jews be deported. The forces of senior SS and police leader Wolf, subordinate to Kesselring, carried out the deportations in the autumn of 1943, with help from Italian fascist auxiliaries. Many Catholic churches and non-Jewish Italians did help thousands of Jews to escape. Even so, 9,000 Jews were eventually sent to the extermination camps with the connivance of the RSI. In Greece, the Wehrmacht provided the same logistical assistance to the deportations as it had provided in the erstwhile German-occupied enclaves of the country. The Kriegsmarine was particularly heavily involved in deporting Jews from the Greek islands. Alongside this damning conduct, it is also worth noting one fleck of humanity. The actions of the army commander on Corfu, Colonel Emil Jaeger, in the spring of 1944. Upon learning that the island's Jews were about to be packed off to the camps, Jaeger cited a number of reasons why the deportations should not take place. He claimed they would cause unrest among the Greeks, and that there was a lack of transportation. Finally, after he was ignored on these counts, Jaeger voiced a clear, if delicately worded, moral objection, claiming the Germans would lose their ethical prestige in the eyes of the Greek population. Although his protests eventually came to nothing, Jaeger has the almost unique distinction of having been a senior German army officer who made a morally principled stand against the final solution. There are other cases of army officers or soldiers who refused orders to kill civilians, and neither these individuals nor Jaeger himself were punished severely. However, this does not diminish their decency. If anything, it increases it, at least in comparison with the far greater number of officers and soldiers who did obey such orders. For that vast majority could not rationalize its obedience by claiming that disobedience would have visited fearful consequences upon them. Whether their motives were moral, like Colonel Jaeger's, or the more commonplace pragmatic ones, like those of General Luntz, there were limits to how much brutality the German army's troops were prepared to mete out during and immediately following the German takeover in southern Europe. But while the army's conduct in Italy and in southeast Europe was not unreservedly savage and barbaric, it was certainly ruthless and ferocious. German prejudice towards Italians and towards peoples of southeast Europe gave the army's conduct an even more vicious edge. The greater force driving it, though, was the Germans' growing economic and, above all, strategic desperation. The demands of the German war economy were ever more voracious, and the Italian military internees suffered especially grievously as they were served up to satisfy those demands. The army, like the Wehrmacht generally, was increasingly desperate not only to exploit the labour of its newly occupied territories, but also even more directly to plug the gaps in its increasingly beleaguered front line. Indeed, the Italian invasion of Italy and the overwhelming firepower it poured onto the Germans at Salerno gave them a fresh, painful reminder of the power that they now faced from all three dimensions of the battlefield. Against this, their continued proficiency in land-based maneuver warfare could provide no long-term answer. In view of this, the fact that German army units treated Italians harshly, exploitatively, and sometimes murderously at this time may also have been due to a process of psychological transference. German soldiers were increasingly frustrated and fearful, as well as brutalized, and so for many of them a spot of killing and rapine at the expense of turncoat Italians may have seemed a good way of letting off steam. This mindset was also likely to leave the army unmoved, and to some extent approving of the fresh wave of degradation and murder that the German takeover of southern Europe unleashed upon the region's remaining Jewish populations. In Yugoslavia in particular, the Germans were already reaping the whirlwind of their rapacious occupation, their cheapskate resourcing of security, their over-reliance on allies and satellites, and their own brutally misconceived anti-partisan policies. Now, in Yugoslavia, as in Greece, Italy's exit from the war stretched the Germans even more severely. In their increasingly brutalized desperation, this development could only make their anti-partisan campaign even more vicious. In Greece, the situation continued to slip from the Germans' control. In Yugoslavia, the situation threatened to engulf them entirely. Among anti-partisan units in the field, the 1st Mountain Division was an especially brutal example, by dint of its elite status and the fanaticism of key officers, of a phenomenon that German anti-partisan units would increasingly exhibit in southern Europe during 1943 and 1944. Hatred of guerrilla warfare now combined not just with prejudice towards the peoples the Germans were occupying, but also with growing anger and frustration as the tide of war turned so visibly and destructively against Germany. Fusing all three, of course, was the National Socialist ideology to which youthful soldiers such as the 1st Mountain Divisions particularly subscribed. It is particularly telling that while some of the soldiers who perpetrated the Komenno massacre balked at massacring women, children, and the elderly, they did approve of the thoroughly National Socialist measure of systematic mass reprisals. Chapter 18. The Eastern Front, 1943-1944. The Ostheer Retreats. Our unit had been re-equipped with new weapons and rapid motor vehicles, and was used to check enemy penetration behind our lines, often achieving prodigies which were cited in the orders of the day. Of course, the general difficulties of our situation, our encirclement, and the despair of troops forced to abandon their weapons in a sea of mud were never mentioned. Nor were such things as the adjutant and his section taken prisoner and liberated too late, or the profound sense of hopelessness and misery which settled over the adult children we were, facing another winter of war. Thus did Guy Sagier's wartime memoir, The Forgotten Soldier, recall his unit's experience in the southern sector of the Eastern Front during the autumn of 1943. The 10 months between July 1943 and May 1944 often get lost in the popular consciousness of the Eastern Front. Granted, none of the battles during this period approached the scale of Stalingrad or Kursk. Nevertheless, this was a key period in the degradation of the German army in the east, one in which the Red Army relentlessly drove it back in the southern sector of the Eastern Front. The Germans were further weakened not just by the Red Army's growing strength and effectiveness, but also by events on other fronts, not least in the skies over Germany itself. The army also lost what remained of its grip on its occupied Soviet territories. The prospect of total victory against the Reich's enemies had already evaporated by 1942, but at least fighting in that year had seemed to offer some hope of withstanding the aggrandized Allied coalition, and possibly of concluding the war on something like favorable terms. Between the autumn of 1942 and the summer of 1943, a succession of defeats had progressively kicked away the foundation stones of such hope. as well as the Wehrmacht's famous land-based defeats in North Africa, the Mediterranean, and the Soviet Union, the Kriegsmarine lost the Battle of the Atlantic, and with it all prospect of halting the Allied build-up for a cross-channel invasion of occupied Western Europe. Meanwhile, the cities and industries of Germany itself suffered fearful destruction at the hands of the Allied bomber offensive. Hitler and the Nazi leadership were especially fearful of the looming onslaught from the resurgent Red Army. They also knew there was no prospect of a negotiated peace with the Allied coalition. Only a tiny minority of army officers, such as Henning von Treskow, were resolved actively to try and conclude the war in a way that might yet avert Germany's national destruction. The solution, which they attempted unsuccessfully during 1943, and would attempt both unsuccessfully and tragically in 1944, was to assassinate Hitler and try to open negotiations with the Allies. However, the vast majority of generals resolved to continue the fight, irrespective of how unwinnable the fight now was. They and the Nazi leadership pinned their remaining hopes on the possibility that if Germany held out for long enough, the unnatural enemy coalition between the capitalist West and the communist East would eventually fragment. That might conceivably give the Reich an opportunity to negotiate a separate peace with the Western allies, at least, and turn its full remaining strength against the Red Army. In truth, fractious though the Allied coalition was, its collective determination to defeat the Reich outweighed any possibility of a split. But for Hitler, the Nazi leadership and the generals who had actively supported their criminal regime, fear of defeat and its consequences fueled hopes of a way out. Hitler himself believed Germany's best prospects lay not just in holding out, but also in defeating any Allied landing in Northwest Europe. Inflicting such a blow on the Western Allies, Hitler believed, might discourage them from continuing the war. In October 1943, Hitler issued Directive No. 51, in which he proclaimed a Fortress Europe policy. Defensive walls would shield the Reich and Nazi-occupied Europe from further attack, the Atlantic Wall against the Western Allies and the Eastern Wall, Ostwall, against the Red Army. German industry would brave the Allied bombing offensive to continue its now re-energized armaments production effort. It would also generate so-called Wunderwaffen, wonder weapons, that would bring Germany eventual victory. Jet aircraft, a new generation of U-boats, flying bombs and ballistic missiles. Hitler's directive also announced an immediate significant transfer of forces from east to west to defeat any attempted invasion by the Western Allies. The massive downside for the Ostheer, of course, was that it would now be stretched even more painfully than before. This process had already started with the Allied invasion of Italy. Now German armies on three fronts would tussle for manpower and material. The fact that different high command bodies were responsible for them, the OKH in the east, the OKW in Italy and the west, would intensify the tug of war even more. Senior officers dealt with these depressing realities in different ways. Some, such as General Jodl, simply fled from them. Jodl was a gifted strategist who, by the end of the Battle of Stalingrad, had recognized that the war was lost. However, he could not bring himself to voice these concerns, whether openly or to himself. Instead, he took refuge in desperate hyperbole. At a meeting of Nazi governmental and party leaders on 7 November 1943, Jodl invoked the fear that Germany might face a repeat of November 1918. He reiterated the myth that, on that occasion, Germany had been broken not at the front, but at home. He also pledged that we would defend even the ruins of our Heimat to the last bullet, because it is 1,000 times better to live in ruins than to live in slavery, and that we will win because we must win, for otherwise history would have lost its meaning. There was a great deal more of such sentiment throughout Jodl's speech, but this excerpt conveys the overblown essence of it. Creeping into this speech was a theme of catastrophic nationalism. The belief that the nation and its people must either prove themselves against their enemies or go down to utter destruction would increasingly infect Hitler's own thinking during the war's final months. Other generals, their grip on reality only marginally less tenuous than Jodl's, took their lead from Field Marshal von Manstein. They placed their hopes in some kind of structural reorganization, such as the appointment of a separate commander-in-chief for the East. They also hoped that a strategic withdrawal here and an adjustment of the front there would enable them to free up more troops for the kind of manoeuvre warfare that had always been the army's great strength. Indeed, Manstein's claim that Hitler refused to approve such a doctrine would become a cornerstone of his argument, expounded at length in Lost Victories, that the generals could have saved Germany if Hitler had not tied their hands. However, Manstein was wrong to claim that Hitler always refused to countenance withdrawals. Furthermore, Manstein and the other generals of his ilk could not, or would not, recognize that flexible defense could at best only delay Germany's eventual defeat in the East. What Hitler certainly would not countenance, however, was a separate commander-in-chief for the Eastern Front. Suspecting, indeed with some justification, that Manstein wanted the job for himself, he retorted, "Even I cannot get the field marshals to obey me. Do you imagine that they would obey you more readily?" A third group included Model, promoted to field marshal in March 1944, Schirner and Kesselring. They invoked, if with varying degrees of fervor, the spirit of National Socialist warfare that had been ingraining itself in the senior officer corps since late 1941. The belief that willpower, defensive resilience, and iron discipline were the best guarantors of success. Its most famous or infamous proponent of all was Schirner. His first Army Group command, that of Army Group South Ukraine, came in March 1944. Schirner's first address to the men of his new Army Group conveys something of his command style. "I know how it looks with you. I know your ragged tunics, your tatty boots. I know ammunition and supplies are scarce at the moment, but only through holding on tenaciously can we improve the situation. I am committing myself to help you with all my strength. Our homeland looks upon you with a passionate sense of involvement. It knows that you soldiers of Army Group South Ukraine have the fate of our people in your hands." As Germany's front-line situation grew ever worse, Schirner and like-minded generals would increasingly couple their calls for an enduringly fanatical fighting spirit with a truly terrorizing system of military discipline. Unsurprisingly, these were the generals who rarely had Hitler's ear during the war's final 2 years, and not just because they favored Hitler's way of operating. They also had his ear because Manstein and other maneuver generals were increasingly losing their own case, above all in the Germans' almost ceaseless fighting retreat across the Ukraine between July 1943 and May 1944. The German army faced a new crisis in the southern sector of the Eastern Front even before Operation Citadel was over. 2 days before Hitler called off the operation in an effort to decapitate Army Group centers thrust down into the Kursk salient, the Red Army counterattacked north of Orel. General Galen believed the Soviets would content themselves with gaining good jumping-off spots for later offensives. Given the Germans' growing dearth not just of reliable aerial reconnaissance, but also of opportunities to capture prisoners for interrogation, it is perhaps unsurprising that Galen so gravely underestimated both the scale of the offensive and its intent. By July 1943, the Soviets had grown much more adept at planning their offensives, selecting the best points and timing for an attack, concentrating and deploying their forces, and shrouding their preparations in secrecy. This was an army that not only was largely unrecognizable compared with its predecessor of June 1941, but had also learned valuable lessons from defeats as recent as the Third Battle of Kharkov. It was now developing its own answer to German combined arms maneuver warfare, deep battle. Deep battle did not seek to encircle large numbers of enemy troops. The Soviets would attack on a relatively narrow front, heralded by a massive artillery barrage. The attack would focus consistently on this narrow front, targeting different lines of defense in succession in order to support the first attack wave, before breaking through decisively and then exploiting the penetration. Deep battle was far from perfected in July 1943, and despite the losses they had suffered at Kursk, the Germans were still more adept at maneuver warfare than the Soviets. As soon as the northern offensive began, General Model pulled out the 2nd Panzer Army from the Kursk salient to counter it. Model was able to do this largely because he had been holding back many of the 2nd Panzer Army's units from Operation Citadel. Indeed, he may have been holding them back precisely because, sceptical as he had been as to Citadel's chances, he wished to keep forces in reserve to meet any Soviet counterblow. Hitler, running counter to his image as a stand-fast obsessive, ordered a retreat to the Hagen position, about 80 kilometers, 50 miles, west of Orel, on 25 July. Model executed scorched earth measures during the retreat, destroying the harvest and wrenching a quarter of a million civilians from their homes, measures that would become more commonplace and on a huge scale over the following 10 months of German retreat. Model reached the Hagen position on 15 August, and although the retreat cost the Germans 100,000 casualties, he repulsed the Red Army's attempt to break through it. Indeed, the Red Army's failure to take the Hagen position exposed a problem with the deep war concept. If the first wave did not break through, then the second wave would have to go in against a defender who knew it was coming. The 12th Panzer Division served under the 2nd Panzer Army at this time. In a letter of 19 August, Corporal Werner F. described how 141 enemy divisions and 15 independent regiments stood against us in the Orel region. Our division alone smashed 3 rifle divisions and 2 tank brigades at Bolchov and 2 further divisions and a tank brigade east of Orel. The Soviets' loss of surprise and Model's superior maneuverability combined to deny the Red Army a truly emphatic victory. Time, however, was on the Red Army's side, and he was using it not only to hammer the Germans repeatedly, but also to become ever more proficient. As the Red Army was the land-based force that did the most to break the German army, and the 10 months between July and May 1943 saw it constantly on the advance in at least one large sector of the Eastern Front, its development during this period deserves some attention. By the autumn of 1943, the Red Army had refined its execution of the deep battle principle. Rifle divisions would go in to penetrate the German defences, supported by tank and sapper forces and by mass artillery fire and airstrikes. Armoured forces would then go in to deepen the penetration. The Soviets were still unable to encircle large numbers of German troops. However, by growing more accomplished at attacking several parallel or diverging points, they could at least separate defending German formations and compel them to withdraw. The Soviets also had double the reserves of 1941, 70% of which comprised units that were refitting. The quality of officers continued to improve as the network of military schools, military academies, and officer courses expanded, and innovation and initiative gained freer rein when the Commissar system was abolished in October 1943. Lend-Lease would provide more than 400,000 trucks and other vehicles to the Soviet Union during the war, in addition to the 205,000 the Soviets themselves produced. It therefore played a decisive role in keeping the Red Army mobile and supplied as it advanced westwards. The Red Army was also increasingly well-armed. The T-34 came not only in an improved model, but also in variants. One type, for instance, was equipped with a flamethrower. Tank Corps and Mechanized Cavalry Corps now operated independently from their superior formations, but employed staff officers with radios to control their mobile operations and maintain communication with higher command levels. The Red Army placed enormous importance on its artillery and was able to provide overwhelming fire support for operations. By mid-1943, it could achieve fire superiority over the German army in every offensive it conducted. This superiority already stood at 5-1 by mid-1943. A year later, it had doubled, and by the end of the war, it reached 32-1. Facing such destructive power, the Germans would increasingly rue their own failure to accord artillery the same importance that the Red Army did. The Red Army also used rockets more than the Germans. They were inaccurate, but achieved devastating area fire. By late 1942, the Red Army was developing self-propelled artillery in a big way. Among other things, it equipped new tank destroyers with 85mm guns following tests against captured Tigers. The Red Army also massively expanded its anti-aircraft artillery, particularly 37mm and 85mm anti-aircraft guns. They went a great way towards helping the VVS achieve overall superiority over the Luftwaffe. As for the VVS itself, increases in aircraft production and help from Lend-Lease enabled the Red Army to form larger, more capable aviation formations from 1942 onwards. New radios vastly improved ground communication with aviation units. By the summer of 1943, the Soviets had gained air superiority over the Germans. The Soviets were vastly helped in this by the decision-making of the Luftwaffe itself, and indirectly by the Western Allies' strategic bombing of Germany.